This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We like things to be simple. For example, we think society is emitting too much carbon dioxide, endangering us all with climate change. Dr. Alan Rozich is knocking at the door to make this all a bit more difficult. His first new book is called Other Inconvenient Truths Beyond Global Warming. Let's investigate. Alan Rozich, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Nice to be here.
Now, to start with, Alan, are you saying climate change is not a critical issue?
Climate change, the way I view it, Alex, is a symptom. It's an issue, but it's a symptom. And I think that the underlying cause is really the lack of using renewable resources as part of our functionality for society. The thinking is that ultimately that the push to use renewables will not be for environmental reasons. It'll be to maintain societal functionality as economies around the world continue to expand and there's increased pressure to get resources, driving up costs. So that, I don't want to call it a fallback, so that the option is to go to renewables so that businesses can keep their costs and pricing structure and generally societal functionality in line.
Well, even from a national viewpoint, why keep importing oil and building up all those trade imbalances if you can get it from the sun directly?
Absolutely. And as I talk about in the book, there's not going to be one solution. There's no silver bullet. There's going to be an assembly of solutions, a cobbling of solutions to meet different resource requirements. But the underlying thinking is that solving the resource issue with renewables will go a long way to attenuating global warming and CO2 production.
Well, let's dive right in. You've said humans are heading into a new and dangerous situation, which you call the super nexus. What is that?
The super nexus is a confluence of three things. It's basically the fact that human society is looking at a three-way challenge, and that challenge consists of the desire to have economic and environmental sustainability. At the same time, you have economic and population expansion, and then there's the concomitant depletion of resources and increased cost and decreased resource availability. It's the resource thing that, although it's a three-way nexus, it's the resource aspect that really raises its ugly head. And a lot of this thinking is not just espoused by myself. Folks like the McKinsey Group down in San Francisco have done a lot of modeling on where resources are going and looking at what's going to happen with the increased populations of India and China. Not just the increase in populations, but those populations jumping into higher levels of technological functionality. And then as you go into higher technological functionality as a society, then what happens is you want better food, or you use more energy, and that puts the strain on resources, thus putting the strain on costs for everybody.
Well, thanks to the drought in California, most of us know there is a water problem, but isn't that local rather than a global threat?
I think the California manifestation is a manifestation that is going to be seen around the world. Basically, we are getting stuck with water. There is no energy, for example, in theory anyway, you can get as much energy as you need from the sun. Water, what we have is what we have, and we cannot get more of it. And what people seem to forget, they say, well, okay, let's go and get water out of the oceans. There's a limit there. There's a traffic cop there is that will not allow you to take more water out of, say, the rivers or the oceans, because what you start to do is then you impinge on the local ecology. And if you knock that out, you have other catastrophic consequences. And there are some folks that use the term called peak ecological water. You cannot take so much water out of an environment and that once you go past that point, then the ecology may be irreparably damaged.
So in some different countries, you've been on the ground with solutions to reclaim water. Can you tell us about your experience in that?
Yeah, the first thing that people do, and it's interesting. I think I was listening to one of your previous broadcasts, and the gentleman was talking about efficiency. For example, if you go to Australia or Singapore, for example, and you'll listen to the television, they have commercials about, hey, if you left the faucet on X number of seconds extra, or you took a shower this many minutes longer, you've wasted this many liters of water. So it's kind of a public awareness campaign that they have focused on getting people on efficiency of water use as number one. Then after that, then you have a choice of trying to find different sources of water. And unfortunately, where it's going to all go is we're going to have to use recycled water. That's the sum and substance of it. And one of the articles that I saw, I think it was in the, it's referenced somewhere in my book, I think it was in the New York Times, it was titled, "You're Drinking What?" And talking about the need that we're going to have to use recycled water ultimately.
So that's like cleaning up sewage water and using it again.
Correct. And as unfathomable as that may seem, if you think about it, when you desalinate seawater, that's much cleaner than normal drinking water. So cleaning up sewage water to make sure that it's consumable and it has no bad health effects is not a big stretch. It's more of a psychological stretch.
I agree with you. Now, beyond water, there's also the situation with metal scarcity. Did you look into that?
Yeah, metals, like other resources, they're what one would call a conservative pollutant. That's not a political term. It means that pollutant is not changed. It's not chemically altered. So what you see is, and I think it was a company by the name of Arcadis, they did a pretty extensive evaluation of renewable economies that would pop up in different parts of Europe. And basically what you see is you see people that are, I have a firsthand example. My daughter is going out with a gentleman that works in a firm that reclaims platinum, and their business is absolutely booming because what's starting to happen is that the costs to reclaim the platinum are at or slightly less than having to go out and do a mine. And one of the examples that should be familiar to us all is recycling aluminum. One of the reasons that recycling aluminum is so attractive is that it only costs 5% of the energy to recycle aluminum and make it into new product than the energy cost to be able to have to make it out of bauxite. So those kind of scenarios are going to be playing out more and more, and folks are going to be looking at doing recycling of metals and things like that. It's going to be more of a business that's more the core part of the economy than actually going after what I call old economy resources.
I keep thinking people will start mining the massive dump sites we create to get valuable materials like metals or even plastics. Is that coming?
You know, I think that type of thing is what you've done by throwing things into a dump willy-nilly is that you've made a whole kind of integrated challenge to being able to have to sort out and then process materials to what you're looking for. And I ultimately see that coming. I think it's just a matter of price points, because at some point, there's an example in Massachusetts. It's not metals, but it's with a material called with organics, that source separated organics, they call them SSOs. When they first put the rules in that you couldn't put source separated organics into landfills, people were able to get those very cheaply and process them. Now that there's competition to refine them, it's you have to start to pay a tipping fee. So I think ultimately the answer to your question about landfills is landfills will get there, but I think other options will have to become more expensive. But it's basic economics that will compel then people to go and mine landfills. And, of course, technology will come along because somebody's going to want to figure out a way to make money off of the landfill material, looking at it as a resource.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author Alan Rozich talking about his book, Other Inconvenient Truths Beyond Global Warming. So to avoid climate change, we do need to switch to renewable energy. But Alan Rozich, why bother when we're told the world is awash with cheap oil and we have plenty of frack gas?
I think that's a really good question. And that's kind of, to me, to put it politely, a mythology that gets broadcast to the masses that is missing one essential component. Yeah, and to me, fracking is in and of itself, if it's done correctly, it's not this evil thing. But where the mistake is made is that, and these commercials are fairly commonplace on U.S. TV, is that they espouse that, well, there's 100 years worth of gas, and America is the next gas superpower. Well, that may be great, okay, but then you have to ask a couple questions. Question one is, at what rate of per capita use are you talking about for the gas utilization, number one? Number two, a real big question is, what's going to happen as the Chinese and Indian middle classes begin to emerge? And there's a really aggressive competition for energy resources. Everybody knows the Chinese are trying to take materials out of Africa. So if you have 100 years left, theoretically that may be great. The reality is that there's going to be cost competition that may make those resources more difficult or more uneconomically favorable. And that's, I think that's the key. But at the end of this day, we have to consider we're not going to transition to a renewable economy overnight. There has to be a blend, and the trick is having that right blend of renewables and old economy resources to make it to the goal line.
Well, considering the fracking industry is already competing with agriculture for water rights in the American West, what does your book tell us about this relationship between energy and water?
Well, there's the super nexus, and then there's another nexus. It's the food, water, energy nexus, and a lot of folks have been writing about that. That is really playing itself out now in the U.S. And, for example, in the book, I believe I have an example of what's going on in Texas, where if you look at what people are doing, farmers are being compelled to sell their water to fracking operations because fracking needs so much water to be successful. So right there, there's being a trade-off between are we going to eat or are we going to be able to drive cars. That's a real nice case study of that nexus situation working itself out. In this case, it's food, water, and energy, so you're trading off making energy to making food. And that's why it's very important when you look at renewables, you need to look at them with a nexus perspective, because you might have a good idea to have a renewable, but if it has other implications, you got to be careful.
I worry most people won't understand the real impacts of climate change on water and energy. I mean, even the scientists are being surprised lately. And these things can feed on each other. You get feedback loops, and the problems kind of ricochet around in different directions. How do we even describe that problem for people?
I think you have to think of it in terms that the folks at McKinsey came up with a good term. It's called interlinkages, that resources, particularly as we go into stress situations, as the world is now with burgeoning economies and whatnot and lower levels of low-hanging resource fruit on the ground, resources become increasingly interlinked. For example, you need water to make energy, you need energy to make water. And then when it comes to agriculture, you need water to make food, but you also need fertilizer to make food, and you need energy and water to make fertilizer. So in that kind of thinking, everything's interlinked. And that's why if you think about some situations where, let's say, you have an environment that is dry and there's a lack of water, some energy alternatives, you want to look at the energy alternative that has the least amount of water requirement. So it's no surprise that wind energy is quite a favorite in Texas. And that's kind of another example of the nexus working in reverse, where people are putting in that as a renewable alternative because it does not require water.
Are there other threats, Alan, that lie in wait for us to form the super nexus that you've written about?
Well, there are some of the threats that are there would be things like being careful about, in at least in our water systems, that we are discharging, for example, small quantities of compounds that are either man-made or they're in nature that have very profound effects on aquatic life and humans in terms of modifying endocrinal functionality. So these compounds are called endocrine disruptor compounds. Maybe that's not directly relatable to global warming, but it is a threat that has emerged over the years because of everybody being so packed in tight, and then our use of cosmetics and pharmaceuticals, and then those materials pass through water systems and go into the water systems. That's one example that I can think of right off the top of my head.
Now, in your book, you suggested reducing CO2 emissions won't come from governments or climate treaties, but from big business. For me, that's kind of a scary thought since, well, this complex of consumerism and big business got us into this mess, and some industry has fought off serious action on emissions reduction. Why do you look to business for solutions?
I think that the reason I'm I'm looking at it that way, is I don't think that I'm looking at business to embrace things out of because it's the flavor of the day. The argument is it's an economic argument. So if you're a business, and you can start to see some of this, but there's some surprising companies out there doing really interesting things with renewable resources. For example, Walmart has the second largest solar installation base in the United States. And people like that would not be making these moves towards renewables just because somebody in Hollywood says to do it. I think the fundamental aspect is that renewables provide a couple of things to businesses. They're ultimately going to provide a more cost-effective source of resources. And then the other thing they provide is price security. And then the other thing that people are looking at these days, it's called resource security. Okay, so if you're a business and you have to go locate somewhere, you know, say you're an agricultural business and you need to locate somewhere and you're not sure if you can get shipments of fertilizer in, you're going to have a tough day. You are basically kind of rolling the dice with a source that you have no control of. Whereas if you have a renewable mechanism or technology in place, then you can renew those resources and you have not just price security, but then you have resource security. And I think you're going to see more businesses looking at resource security, which means in order to keep their shareholders happy, they're going to have to keep have resource security, and that's what's going to compel them to move down that road.
You know, Alan, looking into your background, I found it hard to classify where you are coming from. You don't seem like a lefty or an academic at a university. Who do you work for, and what do you do?
Okay. Well, right now, I work for a couple of companies. The company that sponsored me is a company called InPipe Technologies that has a really unique means of reducing organic loading to treatment plants, to wastewater treatment plants, using bacteria in sewer systems. But my overall background is I went to Ohio State and got a bachelor's and master's in civil environmental, worked for the city of Columbus. Then I went on to get a doctorate at the University of Delaware, worked on faculty there a little bit, and then spent a lot of time in consulting and technology development over the years. So I've got a fairly broad experience base, and a lot of it is in the trenches. So I've seen it from when it was the EPA first starting the movement in the 70s to the whole renewable and sustainability movements that started to happen in the 90s.
Now, as we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, just a couple things. One is that there's a lot of doom and gloom out there, but there is hope. We have the tools. We have the ability to make the changes. And the other aspect is that if you have any doubt about the veracity or the reality of a certain approach, whether it's someone that's offering a renewable or someone that's practicing some other environmental practice that may not be too appealing, break out the science and engineering. There's nothing like some really good science and engineering to kind of demystify what's going on. And that's why I spent a lot of time in the book going through some of those principles, because that's important so that the citizenry can be empowered to make the proper decisions and ask the right questions.
Listeners, I asked Dr. Rozich to come on the show because he's not just another voice in a chorus. I think his book has some different sources and directions that do need serious consideration. It isn't just our CO2 emissions. It's our whole civilization, the way we function, that has to be looked at again. The book is Other Inconvenient Truths Beyond Global Warming, and it's available in all the usual places. You can find a bit more on Alan's Facebook page called Other Inconvenient Truths. Or get that link in my own weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Alan Rozich, thank you for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's been my pleasure, and I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting.